Welcome to the History Factory podcast. In today's episode, we'll be chatting with Bridget Jones, founder and principal of Bridge Builders Historical Consulting, as well as assistant executive director at Arabia Mountain Heritage Area and Alliance outside of Atlanta, Georgia. I've had the pleasure of knowing Bridget since 2018. At that time, she was an interpreter at Belle Mead Plantation outside of Nashville, Tennessee. Her work specifically focused on centering and interpreting the lived experiences of enslaved people at that plantation site. This work really was quite revolutionary. It was picked up by different media sources across the country, including NPR. I have since marveled at her career, the way she's pivoted from historic site interpretation to state museum, to creating her own consultancy that works with large brands like Tommy Hilfiger and beyond. Her work has even expanded into documentaries like Facing North. And she has been featured on NPR and PBS more recently for her work with The Moth, a live storytelling event. Her work really includes and centers on the preservation and interpretation of a variety of social histories of many diverse cultures and communities that have made their way into the American story. During today's episode, we'll talk about her career, her learnings along the way, and how she has continually evolved her perspectives in the space. She's also very knowledgeable on the state of DE&I initiatives at different companies. We'll get into that as well. We'll talk about the role of empathy and emotion in historic interpretation, as well as how brands and companies can inject empathy into the work they're doing. We'll also discuss reparative actions that can take place, as well as the work that needs to be done beyond performative work that we see very commonly within the world of DE&I. It's always a pleasure and a joy to talk with Bridget, and I am so excited to share this with you. So let's get into it. Here's that interview with Bridget. Bridget, thank you so much for being with us today. We're so excited to talk with you. Could you just provide us like a brief introduction on who you are, what you've done in your career, and what you're currently doing?
Man, yeah, how much time we got now? I come from the history world, obviously. I got my career as an entry-level interpreter at what was then called the Belle Mead Plantation, that is now known as Belle Mead Historic Site and Winery today. And I kind of worked my way up the ranks there. So full disclosure, it is actually a plantation, owned 136 enslaved people by 1860, owned by the Harding and Jackson family. It's in Nashville, Tennessee. So I gave costume tours of a plantation, and probably the best introduction to the public history world that I could have had. So I spent quite a bit of time there. I worked my way up. I became the first African-American director ever at the site. Not the executive director, but just the director. And I eventually got the title of not only director of African-American studies, but I also served as director of equitable partnerships. So in my time there, I spearheaded the curation of an exhibit called Journey to Jubilee. Journey to Jubilee was a research project turned re-exhibit once we were able to really like talk about Belle Mead's role in the institution of slavery for the state of Tennessee. When they were honestly ready to discuss it, we did a re-envisioning of it, and that's why I came in at. That also turned into a tour, so the Journey to Jubilee tour experience, where you could come to Belle Mead and take a tour that focused solely and specifically on the lives of the enslaved. And that's kind of where my career really began to bubble. So that goes viral in 2018. And I did that for about a year and a half. And then I became a curator for the state of Tennessee. So I was curator of social history for the Tennessee State Museum for a little over a year, which really broadened my perspective from more of a Middle Tennessee local view to statewide and looking at all three of the grand divisions. And my focus was primarily African American history, but definitely diverse histories because there's not enough representation across the board for everybody that exists. And I ended up going back to Belle Meade, focusing again on enslavement. I did a lot of work with reparative action, which looks at how sites of conscience like Belle Meade, plantation museums in general, can be beneficial to the communities that they disenfranchised through the institution of slavery. So we created a scholarship that goes to Tennessee State University to incoming freshman students that major in history with a specific focus to African American studies. And that is to increase the number of Black people who choose history as a career path. We did lots of other cool things that just really focus on the inner city of Nashville. And then I recently left there about 6 months ago, and I'm now in Atlanta, and I'm the assistant executive director for Arabian Mountain Heritage Area Alliance, which is the nonprofit arm of the National Park Service. And we oversee the cultural, social, and natural history of DeKalb, Henry, and Rockdale counties, which is right outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Whew. And that's the short version.
And all along the way, you've also, you have your own consulting group. So can you talk a little bit about how you from your position and the experience you had, you then parlayed that into working with some big brands and some big institutions, I would say, across the US.
So when I was at Belle Meade and we were doing the Journey to Jubilee thing, and it's getting really good. One day I get a call from our director of marketing, and he's like, "Hey, Tommy Hilfiger is about to come here and do a tour, but they specifically requested Journey to Jubilee." And I was like, "The Tommy Hilfiger or just the company?" He was like, "Just the company, relax." And they were doing essentially diversity, equity, accessibility, and inclusion training. And they were using Belle Meade as a way to kind of give their more less melanated people an idea into what Black history is foundationally, and Black American history is foundationally. And they chose Belle Meade. It was great. The tour is amazing. I give my most riveting rendition of my tour, and after the tour, people are in tears and sobbing. And their VP, one of their VPs, walks up to me and she's like, "Hey, can we do this with just you?" I was like, "What do you mean, just me?" She was like, "Could we just pay you to do this for us?" And I was like, "Sure." And that turned into about a year-long consulting opportunity with Tommy Hilfiger brand. So I did some like monthly calls with them for quite a while. But it would be like company-wide. So I have a lot of great love for Tommy Hilfiger. But that's when I decided I was like, okay, I got something here. Like there's a way to capitalize on this work that I'm doing within empathy and history. And from there, the ball just kind of kept growing. And I did some documentaries, most notably Facing North, which tells the history of Jefferson Street in Nashville, Tennessee, historic Black community. That turned into some work with HCA, the insurance, the healthcare company. And man, it's honestly snowballed. And now I don't think I should take on any other project. Like, I think I'm booked.
How did and I think you and I were connected back when Journey to Jubilee really went viral. It was picked up by, I think, a lot of different news outlets, and that's when we first connected. How did you see the transition from utilizing like the public historian role and then coming into a corporate setting and kind of level setting, adding value, doing that work? What were some of the steps you took or the differences you saw?
Great question. I the thing that I realized that worked for me with Journey to Jubilee was the empathy part. So there's a portion of that tour where I repeatedly ask, "How does it feel? How does it feel? How does it feel?" And I'm asking that in several different concepts. So looking at the role that enslaved women must have played and how they must have felt, especially those of them who were having these intimate relationships with the men who owned them. And then how does that affect the family dynamic? How does it feel to have to go to work every single day and bear the brunt of someone's anger and aggression and resentment for a situation you didn't ask for but can't control in regards to how his wife may not feel about this enslaved woman? How does it feel? So really trying to put people in those shoes, how that translated into corporate was because everybody got feelings. And I could use that feeling. I could use that desire for empathy and for connectedness and understanding of another human being to get brands to look at how they connect to their audiences. Because your archive is one of your strongest assets. It's your company. It's the history of it. There's a story here, and stories are what connects people. And once I realized that, and I was able to pull off of that empathy, I could find the history of any organization and make it relevant to not only the company, but to the audience, to your consumers. So yeah, man, that empathy piece, working on Bell Mead and really having to really hone in on, because really, how does it feel?
Let's hold space for that. I think that's a really impactful statement. And just the way you frame that, I think has incredible value in framing those narratives. Why is it so important that companies contextualize their history? How, especially those, right, that intersect with various communities?
I think that when you sell me something, I, as a consumer, first have to trust what you're selling me. In American history, a lot of these companies have not always been equitable in access for people of diverse groups. So I think it's extremely important for brands to utilize their archive to tell both the good and the bad of their story, especially in this modern era where everything is hyper-analyzed. You cannot shy away from your history. We remember what you said in 95, in 85, in 72, in 62, and for some companies, 1864 and 63, and the sides that you chose in some of America's greatest moments. The best thing that you can do is own it. And then rectify it. And that's where that reparative action work comes in. I think not only is it important for you to act to realize the actuality of your history and to be held accountable for it and to acknowledge and accept that that's great, but now how are you giving back to those communities that you may have hurt through your branding, through your marketing, or through, the political side that you chose? Your history is that is your brand, and people don't forget.
And it's not new, right? It's not something that has been just recently revealed or discovered. It exists in that, like I call it receipt keeping of time. So I think to the point that you made, it is the most powerful, it's the most effective when these companies can own that, right? And navigate some uncertain waters, right? But I think to the point you made earlier, Bridget, it's about empathy and understanding and connectedness, especially to consumer communities that you mentioned. So thinking about this and the importance and why companies should be doing it, from your point of view, what's the value? What's the business value in it doing that interpretive work?
Because everybody wants to feel seen. Everybody wants to feel understood and acknowledged. When Beyonce dropped, honestly, anything, I am always like, she is talking to me. And that's interpretation. I mean, her interpretation is just through music. There's so many ways to do this type of interpretive work. To your consumers, you want to interpret something that they can understand. Again, it's that feeling. They got to be able to feel it. They need to look at this and see themselves. That's why representation is so important. And through the lens of history, we want to see, like, how did you help? F speaking for myself, How have you empowered Black women? How have you empowered Black people? How have you empowered Latino people, brown people? What have you done through the crux or through the arc of your existence as a brand that makes me look at your brand and say that this is something that I could wear and I could wear proudly, or I could consume and consume it proudly? There are some brands, and I don't gotta call any names, but we all know a lot of these brands, especially some of the more expensive ones, are not always the most interpretively inclusive, which is fine if that's your market, that's your market. But you can't market in this way. You can't interpret your brand in this way to the consumer audience and then wonder why they're not your audience, if that makes any sense.
I think it makes sense. I think it does. I think it does. So, okay, if we're not going to name names of the brands that are or companies that are maybe not getting it right, who is getting it right? We're in the midst of Black History Month right now. Where, like, from your point of view, what brands really understand the value and are contextualizing their experience or their audience's experiences, especially those contributions or the communities that, like, that they choose to market to? Who's doing it right?
Yeah, really doing the work right now. I think, and this connection I was super grateful for from you, Pierre Moss. I mean, obviously he is a Black man, but the Pierre Moss brand is doing amazing work with the reclamation of Black history and the Black story, and using that through fashion. I think that's awesome. Of course, Telfar is super in the mix right now with representation and making sure that products are not only accessible, but accessible socially, accessible financially. Like, you don't got to be rich to have a Telfar bag and still be fly, and your favorite celebrity still has one on. If I cross the line, I would think that Adidas is doing pretty good. They're making some really great strides. Levi is it, I'm really impressed by them lately. I follow a lot of their people on LinkedIn. I'm a big supporter of LinkedIn. Tommy Hilfiger obviously is doing their best right now. Ben and Jerry's is such an advocate and an ally. I don't even eat ice cream, but I am here for Ben and Jerry's and their work in the community. So yeah, I think they're my favorites right now. That's who I'm paying attention to. I love I'm from inner city Memphis, Tennessee. I was a kid in the 90s. So, I mean, I love the big designer brands. And I think that Gucci is doing a great job performatively.
Ooh. I'm gonna leave that there. Leave some room for that in the space. So we have just discussed a few fashion brands and sportswear brands. What industries do you think have the opportunity to interpret their histories and reflect these communities, especially those of, underrepresented audiences, contributions by, of Black and by Black Americans? What industries do you see that could benefit from this work?
Oh, I mean, obviously fashion is, and I won't just say fashion, high-end fashion could benefit the most. I mean, obviously high-end is meant to be exclusive. That is quite literally their brand. But there are rich people of color too, who can afford your clothing, can afford your materials, but also don't want you clocking them the minute they hit the door and following them around the store when they come in. So I mean, and everybody knows this about fashion. So other than that, let me think. Geez. Food, grocery stores. Man, I wish that Whole Foods was more accessible. And I know this is something that they deal with on a lot because they come up a lot in conversations about environmental racism and food deserts, things of that nature. And we get it. Business is business. Everything is about the bottom line. But it's 2024, and there are so many neighborhoods where, like, the freshest grocery store they have is like Save-A-Lot. And, you know, respect to Save a Lot for serving those communities, but why can't we in these communities get organic food, fresh organic food? Like, I mean, I know there's systemic issues and reasons, I get it, but I think the grocery industry could really benefit from some of this too, because they got their own history of not always being the most inclusive. And last but not least, I want to say the hair care industry. I think that we see a lot of Black hair brands come up, and they are these locally sourced, homegrown, grassroots like things, like what, Honey Pot is a great example. And they build up these brands, they do amazing. Some big conglomerate is going to come buy them, and then you start to see the people in the commercials get a little bit lighter skinned. The curl pattern gets a little straighter. And before you know it, the brand that was marketed to Black women like me and my cousins aren't the women that we see represented in the ads. And, you know, if I could tell these big conglomerate industries anything, is that we see it and we notice.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very valid point, is, you know, thinking of the founder story and how powerful the founder story can be, and maintaining some of that narrative and representation, right? Even through acquisitions and, you know, these portfolio companies managing that brand.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. So thinking of where you are and where industry is going, and I would say through this next year and beyond, like get through 2024, where do you see this work evolving in the future in your work, especially the work with brands and interpretation? I would say you're also inhabiting public space and of interpretation with your work currently.
Yeah, ironically, there's been a lot of chatter on Twitter. I'm a big Twitter fan, but my Twitter is not professional. If you follow me on Twitter, I swear to God, you cannot judge my tweets. But I've been seeing the conversation happen about DEI positions being cut in several, across the sector, in every sector. And, you know, a lot of these positions were created as a result of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery murders in 2020 during the pandemic. And we know that there was this mass, like, we're going to be hyper conscious and empathetic, and we're going to have town hall meetings. I'm talking across industries. And now I fear that it was what Black people thought it was to begin with. We knew it was performative to a certain extent. We knew it was because you knew that Black dollars are very impactful. If Black folks don't do nothing else, we're going to spend some money. We might not have no money to spend, and we're going to spend some money. And because of that, we don't want to lose you as a consumer, but we don't want to do the work to be actually equitable, actually empathetic. Because that takes time, that takes patience. And when the thing about big business is time is money. So it means for me to take the time to be empathetic, that means I might got to lose a little money. And that's the American way, right? What I see happening is this continuing, sadly. Until the next George Floyd, you know, I think that America is a reactionist country. We love to react when something happens, and we react in these big ways. And it means so much in the moment, but that follow through is short-lived in many cases. And I think that until we recognize that these issues are long-term, they're systemic, there's not enough band-aids that you can pull out of a box to cover it, we have to do the continued work. It's like, if I go get lipo today, like, yeah, I'm gonna look good for the next 6 months, but if I go back to eating cheeseburgers every day, I'm gonna be chubby again. So how do we continue to activate this muscle of empathy? I'm not super hopeful.
So Bridget, I would love to get your perspective on performative DEI at companies, especially considering its prevalence after the murder of George Floyd.
I think that what we saw post George Floyd was what needed to happen. There was a response, and it was a necessary response. We needed to begin to look at how race impacts every industry, from material industries to the history industry to marketing, you name it. Race impacts how we view the world and how we view each other, particularly here in America. And what we began to see is that everybody seemed to take notice of that right after George Floyd was killed. Everybody said, okay, maybe we've been approaching this the wrong way. Maybe we should be more empathetic. Maybe we should be more open-minded to these new ideas and ways of viewing and understanding people who don't look like me. But that was great for a while. After so long, though, it seemed like DEI became a buzzword. It became a trigger. And people would say it to sound really woke, quote unquote, and to sound really empathetic. But the work was there. So now you've hired all of these individuals. You've hired very qualified people to do these very important jobs. But most of the time, it seems like people didn't really believe in those departments. It was so they won't get canceled. We don't want our company to be canceled. We want to keep bringing in black dollars, but we don't want to actually do the necessary work continuously to ensure that black people have an equitable stake in this company, in this industry. And now you're seeing those things be rolled back because, George Floyd has been gone a while now and everything's okay, so we think. And it's the farthest from the truth.
What are some, what would you consider some of the performative DE&I activities of companies? What would qualify them as being performative versus the doing the work?
So the big thing that was really popular after George Floyd was killed was the changing the profile picture on Instagram to black. I get the purpose of it, but what does it really do? That was probably the biggest ick that I had was that black profile picture. But also Black History Month, Juneteenth, all these posts. When you have black employees who are working at your company that are usually laughing at these posts because you post the post. You write the caption, it sounds great, but you have someone over here who has been looked over for a promotion for the last 4 years, but is your top earner. And then also you have the hiring of all of these people. You bring them in to do this work, this DEI work, and then you don't give them the agency that is necessary for them to do the work in a way that really changes company culture. And I think that's probably the biggest one of all of them. The rest of them are just small little things that got on my nerves, but you bringing people into your company to do the type of work that your company actually needs, but then not allowing them to do that work, that was the problem.
Yeah, I agree. I also feel like the DE&I work that's necessary, or DEI and B that's necessary, is work, right? It's not a marketing campaign. And I think maybe, like, to the point you made earlier, it felt very much like signaling that the work was being done. In actuality, to your point, maybe it wasn't. Right. Or the individuals who are in positions that hold the title don't have, to the point you made, the agency to make the change. That, and everybody wants change, right? Everybody is so willing to stand behind change, but it is hard work, and it's a long journey, and it is not finite, right? It's not like you do it, you're done. It's
It's a
continual.
continuous process, And I think that's the thing that companies have to realize is that this isn't something that you're just going to do one time. You don't get to hire the black person or the Middle Eastern person or the Latino person and say, okay, we're diverse now. That's not how this works. You have to actually listen and understand if your company is 98.9% white and you hire five people of color, that doesn't make your company diverse. It's not diverse until the thoughts and the beliefs of various cultures are represented within the motto, in the creed, in the mission of the organization. That's true diversity.
And I think being very mindful of who your consumer base is, and do you reflect the people that you're serving through your products and services, right? And being very mindful of that, like inclusion, and not letting that go by the wayside.
I think that Reebok did an amazing job with that when they hired Pierre Moss for creative director. That was a wonderful move. Or was it? Yes, it was Reebok.
Yep. So Kirby Jean Raymond. Yep.
Yes.
He's the creative director for Pierre Moss. And then he also acted as creative director at Reebok. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I would say now at Reebok, you're also seeing the opportunities for previous athletes to hold leadership roles. So both Shaquille O'Neal and Allen Iverson both have leadership roles within their basketball division, right? So both former NBA players, Hall of Famers, and they now can help direct the future of that category. So I would say yes, reflecting and including the lived experiences and expertise of former athletes, of your consumers, of your, of the collective in the future of a company, for sure. So you talked a little bit before about the importance of injecting empathy into work. If that's the work of interpretation, definitely, I think empathy has a place within corporations and in business in general. How do you recommend companies inject empathy both within the interpretation of their history as well as just day-to-day work?
Listening. I know it sounds really simple. Listening, active listening, whether that be anonymous survey. I personally prefer non-anonymous survey. For companies who are looking to do this outside of their intercompany community, if you're just looking at your audience and the demographic that you serve, I would say town halls, anything that really allows you to engage with the community, whether that be public programming events, and then actually listen to the things they say. And you have to be okay when they say stuff that you don't like. That is the biggest part. You can't come to a culture or a community and say, hey, how can we be better? And then when people give you the thing that you would need to do to be better, you say, oh, well, I thought we were already doing that. Or, oh, that just makes me so uncomfortable. You know, the point of empathetic interpretation is understanding that you might not like it when you are a part of the majority. Giving people an opportunity to really speak from their heart and say what they feel about your organization, and then not only listening, but working towards fixing what they said fix. That is how you do it. And it seems really simple, but for some reason, it can be so difficult for organizations to implement that.
Yeah, no, I've been in situations where I'm very aware that someone is listening to respond instead of listening to understand. So I think that is such a good piece of advice, is to listen to understand and not take it personally. You know what I mean? I think there's so much value in creating space for someone to share their lived experience. And maybe you don't have the right quote unquote answers or know what to do immediately following hearing some feedback or community engagement or market research. But allowing for that space, right? And validating them, I would say, by doing the work.
Yeah, that's it. Listen and then go do the work. It's the thing your teacher taught you in like third grade. It's, who knew that it would be this important in our adult career lives?
Yeah, it very much is. Is there anything else you would like to add or discuss or talk about as it relates to your work or the work of empathy, the work of DE&I, the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I think we have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. We have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. I know my story on the moth just went live on the radio. And one of the things that I keep hearing back via my email and my DMs is that this made me so uncomfortable in the best way. Thank you so much. You have to be willing to be uncomfortable because that is the only way you're going to grow. Yeah. So if I could encourage companies and organizations and individuals to do anything else, it would be to become comfortable with being uncomfortable as we push harder for DEAI to become a commonplace in America.
Great. I'm going to leave it with that. That was such a powerful ending.
Thank you.
Bridget, thank you so much for your time today. It's always a pleasure, and I'm so impressed with all the work that you've done and you're continuing to do in all of the spaces that you inhabit.
Thank you.
A thank you to Bridget Jones, principal and founder of Bridge Builders Historical Consulting and assistant executive director at Arabia Mountain Heritage Area Alliance. I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did. Incredible insights, great perspectives, and a way for all of us to think a little more deeply about representation in the work we do. Until next time, stay well.